This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa. JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharisa, the editor-in-chief over at numberfire.com, and this is episode 17 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the Number Fire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. My body melted last night. I think if I wrote a novel or something, that's how I'd start it out. I'd start it out by saying, "My body melted last night." That's a good attention grabber, right? You'd be interested in what the rest of the book had to say. But it did. Playoff hockey got the best of me again, but my Penguins are going dancing with Lord Stanley for a second straight year, guys, and I am super, super pumped. And I'm sure you don't care at all. So instead of talking about Chris Kunitz and his improbable Game 7 performance for a couple minutes, I'll skip over my hockey homerism and talk about what you guys care about, and that's football. Let's dig into this week's mailbag. This first question is from Adam Cahill via email, and if you have questions that you want to send me via email, you can email me at jj@numberfire.com. He says, "You've been a huge advocate for drafting Frank Gore in redraft despite his age. What are your thoughts on other players that are theoretically past their age apex? How does age impact your single season projections? In what situations does it have more or less of an impact?" So, just to be clear, I'm strictly talking redraft here. Dynasty's a different beast, naturally, because you're holding on to those older players each and every year. But, generally speaking, we're at a point in time where fantasy owners are savvy enough, and age is pretty much baked into these players' average draft positions as a result. For instance, let's just look at Frank Gore. You brought up Frank Gore. I think it's a really good example. Let's look at him. Realistically, Gore has what you would want in a fantasy football running back. He's in a good offense, he should see a large market share of his team's touches, and he'll even be on the field a lot in passing down situations. That's what led him to finish as the 12th best running back in fantasy football last year. But today, he's being drafted as RB37 in MFL 10 drafts, and he's RB35 on fantasyfootballcalculator.com. Meanwhile, his situation really hasn't changed that much. I understand they drafted Marlon Mack, who I don't mind as a player, but Mack isn't necessarily ready to handle a massive workload like Gore has seen. So there are two reasons as to why Frank Gore has fallen so far in drafts given what he did last year. The first one is age, and then in turn, upside. I say in turn because people don't see upside in older players. They're not wrong, but Gore's upside isn't as bad as you probably think. Last year, only seven running backs had more top 24 performances than Frank Gore. Only seven running backs had more top 18 performances, and only 12 running backs had more top 12 performances. For all intents and purposes, he was at least a high-end RB2 last year. Whether you're looking week to week or from a cumulative standpoint, Frank Gore was at least a high-end RB2 in 2016. And again, I'm just talking about Frank Gore here because I think it's a really easy example to walk through and show that, generally speaking, with these old players, their downside with age is just baked into their ADP. Adam, in this email, he listed some other players who are old, and you can basically make the same case for almost all of them. Larry Fitzgerald catches 107 passes last year. Only 9 wide receivers had more top 24 performances than Larry Fitzgerald last year did in PPR formats. And he's being drafted at wide receiver 25 in MFL 10s. What's the reason for that? The reason for that is because Larry Fitzgerald is old. Ted Ginn, another guy, he could hit 100 targets this season in the Saints offense. And on Fantasy Football Calculator, Ted Ginn is being drafted behind Cooper freaking Kupp. Ted Ginn's age and perceived upside as a result of that age is already baked into his ADP. As for players like Adrian Peterson, Marshawn Lynch, Danny Woodhead, I view them a little bit differently. Two of them are coming off big injuries, and one of them didn't even play football last year. Those are red flags at an older age on top of just being older. But their ADPs, maybe aside from Marshawn Lynch, aren't horrific given the potential upside for those guys. So the bottom line here, age and the potential for a drop-off, fall-off-the-earth season is already baked into these players' average cost right now. So it doesn't turn me off all that much from drafting them. This next one is from @FFB_Greek. How do any strategies change for half PPR leagues, and would you lean towards PPR or standard rankings? So one of the biggest misunderstandings with PPR leagues is that owners make the assumption that wide receivers become more valuable. They are when you can throw them in a flex spot. That's true. Because wideouts will score more in full PPR leagues or even in half than running backs. But the difference between wide receivers within the position doesn't change as much as the difference between running backs. Think of this just intuitively. The top wide receiver might catch, let's say, 100 passes in a season. Do you think another top wide receiver is going to get there by catching 50? No, of course not. The difference in receptions among tiers isn't all that drastic. Antonio Brown, Odell Beckham, Julio Jones, sure, Odell Beckham might not catch as many passes as Antonio Brown because Odell Beckham might not see as much volume as Antonio Brown, but the difference in receptions is not that drastic. But it is at running back. David Johnson had 80 catches last year and finished as RB1 in PPR formats. Zeke Elliott had 32 and he finished as the RB2. That type of difference at wide receiver just doesn't happen in similar tiers. So in general, look at running backs with a closer eye whenever you're switching from standard to PPR, and pick guys who catch passes when shifting to that format. Half PPR leagues are generally, you have to look at it generally the same way. As for which rankings to use, I would assume that rankings aren't going to change all that dramatically from one to the next. Partially because rankings are already inherently subjective, and people aren't creating them in a very mathematical way. For more on that, by the way, you can listen to episode 12 with Mike Clay on building projections. You gotta love some shameless self-promotion. Next, we have a question from Scott Cumming via email. He says, "Hey JJ, hearing you talk strategy on the mailbag episode has had me wondering about keeper league strategy. One, in relation to this year, is it more prudent to keep an RB alongside a wide receiver given the position scarcity? Two, is it more essential to take a talented player or a real draft value keeper? Weighing Devontae Freeman in the first against the likes of Ty Montgomery in the ninth and LeGarrette Blount in the 13th. Thanks, Scott." This is another great topic that I like to dig into because it's all about opportunity cost. And I love opportunity cost. I'm a nerd for opportunity cost. For instance, if you're in a single quarterback keeper league, never keep a quarterback. Why? Because not only do you know that you can get one late in your draft, but you're foregoing the opportunity of keeping a cheap running back or wide receiver by keeping that quarterback. It's almost doubly worse to keep a quarterback as it is to draft one early. So to answer your first question about positional scarcity, in almost every league format, you're going to want to keep only wide receivers and running backs. Doesn't matter if it's one of each or two of one. You just want those positions. Those are the positions that you want to keep. The first thing you should do when looking at keepers, though, is the round or cost you'd be keeping that player versus his average draft position or projected average draft position, since the draft will look different with a handful of keepers off the board. So if your whole team is keeping a guy or two, you know that you're essentially starting with the third round rather than the first round. I'm sure Devontae Freeman would be a first round pick in a keeper league, but if you can actually get Devontae Freeman yourself in the first round and then also keep a player like Ty Montgomery in the ninth, then that's 100% your play. That's what you want to do. If you're married to Devontae Freeman as a keeper, that's totally fine. I get it. But I'm of the belief that we're going to get things wrong and variance occurs in fantasy football. So depending on the other running backs that will be available, I might just say screw it. Let Devontae Freeman enter the draft, get a value like Ty Montgomery for a ninth rounder, and then hopefully select a Devontae Freeman type player in the first round rather than automatically losing that pick for Devontae Freeman, which would lead you to not having Ty Montgomery as well. As is the case for most keeper questions, though, it's really dependent upon what's out there and who your league mates are keeping. But definitely go through the exercise of what's his actual cost versus what I'm paying and what's the opportunity cost in keeping him. In the case of Freeman, the opportunity cost is not keeping a player like Ty Montgomery in the ninth. And who knows, maybe you can end up with Freeman in the draft too. This next one is from Fred, and it's an email. I had to paraphrase it a bit because it was a little long. He says, "You talk a lot about ADP, but since last year I have become a real fan of auction drafts. They give a larger chance to employ a strategy compared to snake drafts, in my opinion, where the team you get slash choose is pretty much dictated within plus or minus a couple of ADP, depending on your draft position. What is your take on auction drafts for either dynasty or redraft leagues?" Guys, I'm a huge, huge auction draft fan. Huge. I've been doing them for years, and actually, I was the go-to auction guy for RotoWorld and their draft kit and magazine for a while as a result of that. But I reference average draft position and snake drafts for two reasons. First, it's easily relatable to the bigger audience. I have to play to the masses. But second, you can look at ADP and generally have a good idea as to how an auction draft might go down. I'll 1,000,000% be doing a show on auction drafts at some point, though. 1,000,000%. I've written about some theories, and I have a lot to say about them. So relating to your question, know that I am one of the biggest auction draft fans out there. Fred's second question, he asked, what is your opinion on stacking when you draft? If there is a player I want to take at wide receiver and the QB is someone I would not be against having, then stacking seems intriguing to me. Thanks. Love your show, Fred. Thanks, Fred. I appreciate the couple questions you asked. So I think you should ask yourself about stacking first. Why do people stack? Or why do they use a quarterback with a wide receiver from the same team? Specifically in daily fantasy, ask yourself why in DFS are people using a quarterback and a wide receiver from the same team? The answer is because they want upside. When the quarterback scores, so does the wide receiver. You get double the points. That's why it's so popular. That's why it's such a go-to strategy and has been for years in daily fantasy football tournaments. But upside also brings weekly volatility. A bad day from the offense means both of those players are going to suffer. So basically what I'm getting at is that I'm not out there seeking a stack. I'm not sitting there in a snake draft and saying, I need to get this quarterback because I have his wide receiver. I just don't think it's necessary when your goal is to make the fantasy football playoffs and you're trying to win week in and week out. Maximize your roster by taking the most valuable pick, not by forcing a particular strategy on your team. This next one is from @JustinFreeman18 on Twitter, and I have an awful answer for it, but it's still going to happen on this show. Which running backs had the biggest gap between volume and production last year and are likely to be bounce back candidates? Lamar Miller comes to mind. Yeah, so Lamar Miller is definitely the one who comes to mind for me too, but I actually am not super into him this year. The team continues to talk about, they talked about it all offseason, Bill O'Brien did, about him getting fewer touches because he couldn't handle the load. And then they went out and they drafted Deontay Foreman. And the offense itself isn't very good. They just don't have a quarterback. They're not going to score many points. And if they're at the goal line, they might end up using more Foreman than we would like because Foreman is a big-bodied back. So while Miller would be a hypothetical bounce-back candidate, you're not wrong at all. That was the dude who I thought of when you asked the question as well. I still don't really love him this year. My projections don't love him either. And there really aren't many candidates out there simply because volume and production are so closely tied together. I wish I could make a case for Todd Gurley, but you all know that I don't like associating my running backs with bad offenses. I don't want to own Todd Gurley, at least not at his cost. So to give you the most terrible answer ever, I don't think there are many. It's a lot easier to pinpoint volume and lack of touchdowns or production with wide receivers than it is running backs, just because there are more of them getting some volume. So if this question were about wide receivers, I could name someone like Terrell Pryor. But with running backs, I don't think there are many of them. This next one is from @Diego24FPS on Twitter. Do you have a favorite non-Lynch running back in Oakland between DeAndre Washington and Jalen Richard? They smell like late round winners. At this point in time, I don't foresee myself owning a lot of Marshawn Lynch shares this year. So I agree. Washington and Richard are pretty intriguing. To me, the answer is actually pretty easy. I think it's DeAndre Washington. When Latavius Murray missed time last year, Washington saw more of the workload between he and Richard, out-attempting Richard by 7 attempts in the 2 games that Latavius Murray missed. And Washington, more importantly, because we don't have that large of a sample size at the NFL level, but Washington has the college football profile. At Texas Tech, he had over 50% of his team's attempts during his senior year, a 6.4 yards per carry average, 60% of the team's rushing yards, and over 41% of his team's touchdowns on the ground. And he still had over 10% of the team's receptions. He had a really good market share profile. It's actually pretty nice. And I looked at playerprofiler.com just to see who they had as a quick comp. Guess who his quick comp was? His number one comp. Devontae Freeman. So you combine that production profile, the market share profile, with that type of comp, and it's pretty intriguing, I'm not going to lie. Jalen Richard's profile is not nearly as nice. He's got a 36% attempt market share during his final season. He never hit 200 rushing attempts in a single year in college. He had 43% of his team's rushing yards his final year, and he even has an inferior pass-catching profile than DeAndre Washington did, despite the fact that I think a lot of people look at Jalen Richard as maybe the better pass-catcher in that backfield. Maybe not, but if you are looking at him that way, I'm not sure that it's that clear-cut. So this all leads me to believe that DeAndre Washington is the guy that you probably want to draft in the Oakland backfield this year. This next one is from at pwiggles69. Hide or wear? A very, very short and basic question, but one that I actually had to think a lot about because I think it's a good question. I'm not really bullish on either guy this year, but I'm still going to look into this because you asked the question and I should give you an answer. Let's look at the pros and cons of each dude. We'll start with Carlos Hyde. The pros: he's in an offense with Kyle Shanahan calling the shots. Can you think of another pro for Carlos Hyde aside from the fact that he's their number one running back? I can't. I legitimately cannot. The cons: the offense sucks and people are really, really hyped about Joe Williams stealing carries in that backfield. So the pro is that he's in an offense that has a mastermind running it. The con is that there's a guy who might dig into his workload and the offense just isn't going to score many touchdowns. That's not going to change. The offense is not going to score that much. Now for Spencer Ware, the pros: he's in a better offense than Hyde, and Andy Reid has been a general boost for fantasy running backs in the past. The cons though: the team just traded up in the third round to get Kareem Hunt, and Ware only has one season in his college and professional career with 200 or more carries, which came last year. Spencer Ware does not have that much experience being a lead back. In college, he had Jeremy Hill there at LSU. Last year, he didn't have anyone. The year before that, there was a split backfield. And remember, the year before last, so 2015, Spencer Ware was very, very efficient, which is why we were really, really excited about Spencer Ware this past season. So to be honest, the pros and the cons are pretty similar between Carlos Hyde and Spencer Ware. I think Hunt is a greater threat for touches than Williams is right away, but I also think the Chiefs' situation for running backs is just generally better, which is why if there wasn't anyone behind these players, if Spencer Ware and Carlos Hyde had no one coming for them, Ware would be my dude between Hyde and Ware. My projections model actually has Ware and Hyde only two attempts apart, and if that's the case, give me Ware for the touchdown upside and the probable yardage upside as well, just because he's in an offense that's going to be a little bit more efficient. But I'm more than likely, again, am not going to own much of either of these players. I'd rather just get the cheaper rookies. The final one is from at Jay Kinney. Have you experienced with any other air horn sounds / volume / cadences? You know, I really haven't. I should consider something like the Pittsburgh Penguins goal horn, though, at some point. It's pretty magical when the team scores and you just hear that constant horn going off. So instead of just using the air horns when I drop something hot, I'll use the goal horn when something really amazing happens, like when Kenny Golladay inevitably catches 80 passes for 1,500 yards this year and sets every rookie wide receiver record imaginable. You know, something like that. That's when the goal horns will drop. That'll do it for this week's mailbag episode, though, everyone. Thank you so much for submitting questions. If you want to submit questions for next week's show, you can get at me on Twitter at LateRoundQB, or you can email me at jj@numberfire.com. Enjoy your Memorial Day weekend, everyone. I'll be back on Tuesday in your ears with Sean Siegel, the creator of the Zero RB strategy. It's going to be a great show. Remember to subscribe so that you don't miss it. Have a good one, guys.